to Sight.
Spend the day with Sight.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m.
on Radio Sight Thursday Live.
Radio Sight Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
Radio Sai now brings you a special musings talk by Professor G. Venkatraman, the former Vice Chancellor of the Sri Satya Sai Institute of Higher Learning. Over to Professor G. Venkatraman.
Loving Sai Ram and greetings from Prashanthi Nilayam. Welcome to my fourth talk in the awareness series, which interleaves with the companion series on the essence of the Gita. Last time, I mentioned towards the end that man must go through life with full awareness of, one, his cosmic nature, and two, his cosmic connection with creation. This awareness is vital because that alone gives expression to the soul of man. If the soul is held in bondage, man's vision would be very narrow, and a person with narrow vision is likely to become very narrow-minded also. Once a person becomes narrow-minded, he becomes an easy prey to greed, avarice, selfishness, jealousy, etc., all of which soon lead to conflicts, and even to very violent conflagrations, of which we see many examples these days. It is thus clear that awareness is closely connected with developing a broad and liberal outlook. An essential aspect of having a broad outlook is to become aware of the omnipresence of God. People often ask, if God is everywhere, how come we cannot see Him? Gandhi answered that a long time ago. He once said, "There is an indefinable, mysterious power that pervades everything. I feel it, though I cannot see it." Gandhi identifies that indefinable, mysterious, all-pervading power with God. Though he could not see it, he said, that power is God. In practical terms, what Gandhi means is that we cannot actually see God everywhere, but we can certainly feel His presence if we want to. Let me amplify. I am sure you would agree that our bodies are made up of atoms of all kinds of elements ranging from hydrogen, oxygen and carbon, all the way to calcium, phosphorus, iron and so on. So is everything on earth. Whether it is the bacteria or the mountains, the land below or the sky above, etc., all are made up of atoms. I hope you would agree that at least where the earth is concerned, there are atoms present everywhere. I suppose you also know that though the atom is extremely tiny and cannot be seen even with a very powerful microscope, it has locked within it enormous stores of energy. In fact, the energy contained in just 5 grams of uranium was enough to wipe out Hiroshima. Since atoms are everywhere, atomic energy is also present everywhere. This energy of the atom is really divine energy immanent in the tiny object we call the atom. We may be able to explain the atomic energy using physics, but physics does not and cannot tell us where that energy originally came from. I'll tell you where it came from. It came from God. Thus, the universal presence of atomic energy is, in my opinion, one simple example of the signature of omnipresence of God. At this point, we must take a minute off to appreciate how beautifully nature weaves the micro and macrocosms together. Let us start with the atom. To get a feel for the size of the atom, consider a distance equal to 1 centimeter. Now imagine 1 billionth of a centimeter. 1 billionth of a centimeter, mind you. Take that as the unit. On this scale, a typical atom would have a size of about 10 units. The energy that devastated Hiroshima and Nagasaki actually came from the nucleus of the atom, which is even tinier. Let's find out how tiny. If we imagine the atom to be like a mini solar system, then the nucleus is like the sun of that system. Now, how big is this atomic nucleus? You would be in for a surprise. Imagine now a distance that is 1 trillionth of a centimeter, not 1 billionth like before, but 1 trillionth of a centimeter. 1,000th of a billion. Take that as the unit of distance. The atomic nucleus typically has a size of about 10 units on this tiny scale of ours. The energy of atom bombs and of hydrogen bombs, which by the way are 100 to 1,000 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb, is contained in the nucleus. That's amazing, is it not? Gandhi did not know anything about all this. In fact, even scientists did not way back in 1930. But Gandhi sensed that the power of God was everywhere. That is what is important for us now. I told you that 5 grams of matter, when converted into energy, could wipe out Hiroshima. Consider a man weighing, say, 100 kilos. This man has a mass equivalent to 20,000 Hiroshima-type bombs. Have you ever thought of that? I don't want you to get the impression that we are all walking bomb arsenals. Fortunately, nature has made sure that this energy can never go off and blast the world. On the other hand, if we wish, we can all be walking torrents of love. But that would happen only when we develop awareness. And so back to our theme. This power of the atom that I have been talking about is the power locked up in the tiny, tiny atomic nucleus. If one goes deeper and deeper into the atomic nucleus, then one would encounter even bigger and vaster reservoirs of energy, such as is packed within the whole of cosmos. In short, every single atom in our body, and there are trillions and trillions of them, let me tell you, every single atom is a reflection of the vast cosmos outside. Thus, speaking even from the point of view of an atheistic scientist, our inside, so-called, is no different from the outside. It so happens that our skin forms an artificial boundary, like those imaginary lines drawn on the face of the earth to earmark different countries. I mean, we may erect a fence and say this side of the fence is India and that side of the fence is Pakistan and fight a lot about where exactly the fence ought to be. But does a bird living there care two hoots about that? It flies all the time from India to Pakistan or vice versa without any security checks, passports, visas, etc. In other words, when we adopt the broader picture, there comes into view a magnificent oneness, in this case, the oneness of cosmic energy, and at least in that sense, one can say there is an indefinable mysterious power that is omnipresent. Back to the body again, and this time we take a look at its biological functions, instead of merely the atoms and molecules. As Swami has said, the human body, and indeed the human being, is God's greatest miracle. Just consider this. Take a look at a stone and a living being like a rat, say. Both are made up of atoms, but there's something special about the combination of atoms that makes up a rat. A rat is a living being. We can all recognize life, but you know something? Life is a force that is not easy to define. Scientists have tried to define life and have given up for the time being. But one thing all grant, including scientists who are atheists, and that is that a living being is aware it exists. A stone, on the other hand, is not aware it exists. We describe this by saying that a living being has the capacity for consciousness and self-awareness, whereas inert matter does not. Vedanta says this capacity is characterized by a force called Prana Shakti, which is a sort of generic name for life force. Scientists are very uncomfortable with this nomenclature, but that is their problem. Scientists recognize various forces like electromagnetic forces, gravitational force, and so on. They have sophisticated theory to describe these forces. They can do all kinds of experiments related to these forces and so on. But when it comes to the life force or prana, scientists no doubt agree that life exists. Do they have a choice? But having agreed that life exists, they leave it there. Consciousness is something that scientists are not at all comfortable about. While some dismiss it as a mere brain faculty, others reluctantly admit that there might be something that goes beyond the mere brain, which is just a hunk of meat. We shall leave all these matters of argument and get down to something practical. We all take our bodies for granted, hardly conscious of what a wonderful system it is. In this wide world, there are all kinds of living species, and each living species has some unique capabilities. The cheetah, for example, can run incredibly fast. The monkey can do amazing feats of climbing, and so on. When it comes to humans, we hardly realize what a tremendous flexibility our bodies have. You do not have to take my word for it. Just watch a tennis match or a cricket match, or for that matter, a ballet, ice skating, or Bharatanatyam performance. Everywhere you would see the amazing flexibility of the human body. Again, consider the human fingers. Have you ever considered the remarkable things the human fingers can do? You can knit, you can stitch, you can paint, you can sculpt, play all kinds of musical instruments from mridangam to violin to the flute, veena, and so on and so on. And then again, using the fingers, one can do surgery, one can paint, do clever spin bowling, and whatnot. Take a simple thing like opening a bottle. Do you realize that without the thumb, we just cannot open the bottle so easily? Try it and you would know what I am talking about. That is why the famous scientist Newton once exclaimed, "The thumb alone is enough to prove that God exists." In short, the body can do wondrous things because, as Krishna has explained, it is divine power that drives the body, the living body. So, God is hiding in every living being also. That's our next conclusion. Now there arises a question. Agreed that the body is packed with innumerable wonders, but in what way does that add to the omnipresence of God? Well, here is where evolution comes into the picture. Now, everyone agrees that the universe is a constantly evolving system. As far as we humans are concerned, there are three distinct stages of evolution that matter. The first stage, there was the actual birth of our universe via the Big Bang, as many say. This birth of the universe took place about 14 billion years ago, and this number, by the way, is fairly precise. In the next stage, our solar system was born, and this happened about 4.5 or 5 billion years ago. After this came the emergence of life on planet Earth, and subsequent to that, life evolved through various species, culminating in the human species. This third stage got underway about 3 billion or so years ago. We shall skip for the moment how life first appeared on Earth, because there is some difference of scientific opinion on that issue. But whichever way life first appeared, everyone is agreed that subsequently life evolved from lower forms like plants and insects to more complex forms like fish, birds and animals. And at the end of it all came man. Okay, but how exactly did this evolution of species take place? Once again, science enters the picture. The broad brush picture was first given by Charles Darwin nearly 150 years ago. And 50 years ago, a molecular basis was given to Darwin's discovery, when the structure of the famous DNA molecule was unraveled for the first time. I have covered all this in some detail in an earlier musings talk, and so I shall not repeat those details here once more. But this much I have to say in the context of the present talk, and that is the following. Biologists believe that species evolve through random mutations of the gene, accompanied by the principle of survival of the fittest. There is no doubt some truth in this theory, but there are strong reasons to believe that genetic mutations, which, by the way, can now be discussed at the molecular level, were not entirely random. Possibly, there was a sense of direction superposed on the randomness. Such phenomena are known in mathematics and are described by the theory of what are called biased random walks. In biased random walk, while the individual processes are indeed random, there is nevertheless a general direction of drift. My favorite example is that of water molecules in the waters of a river. At the molecular level, individual molecules do move in a random fashion. This is a scientific truth which all accept, including myself. At the same time, since the river is flowing down a gradient due to gravity, superposed on the random motion of the molecules is a general macroscopic slow drift in the direction of downstream. In other words, I believe it is no negation of science to say that while individual mutations could indeed be random in nature, macroevolution could, however, have an arrow that arranges the successive steps in a general direction, even as a river flows from a higher to a lower level. This is what some people call intelligent design, implying that evolution knows in which general direction it has to proceed and not have to waste too much time in pointless trial and errors, as 100% trial and error philosophy would require. You might say, all this is fine, but what on earth has it got to do with the omnipresence of God? It's a valid question, and that is what I shall consider next. According to Vedanta, and that is what I shall rely on here, God exists even when the universe does not exist. By the way, this is emphatically reiterated by Krishna in the Gita. So even when the universe does not exist, there is God. This is the formless and attributeless God, or Nirakara Brahman, that Vedanta talks about. This Brahman is also described as pure consciousness. That shall be our starting point. God being eternal, it follows that pure consciousness, which is the same as God, is also eternal. In turn, this means that when the universe comes into being, consciousness pervades the entire universe as a sort of backdrop, invisible and intangible, though the backdrop might be. Okay, so there is this pure consciousness everywhere, even as the universe evolves, our solar system is born, and the earth comes to being, and life emerges on earth. What it means is, all the time while these processes are happening, pure consciousness acts as a backdrop. So what? Let pure consciousness act as a backdrop. Well, I tell you, if pure consciousness is present, it could well direct the evolution process, though in a totally unseen and subtle manner. In other words, to use the language of physics, the presence of pure consciousness during evolution would be like an invisible field against which action takes place in the universe. Scientists would, of course, summarily dismiss this hypothesis, ridiculing it to unfounded religious speculation. However, I do not see why there cannot be the possibility of a higher field that Vedanta would call the field of universal consciousness, which could drive a directed evolution, even as physical fields drive physical and inanimate processes. The concept of mind-matter interaction has engaged the attention of many scientists in the West for nearly a century, and the list has included many star names. People like Max Planck, who first discovered the existence of quantization in nature in 1900, declared that material reality arose from consciousness. George Wald of Harvard, who won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for his investigations on the human eye, said he was forced to admit that matter's primordial source was a mind stuff, as he called primary consciousness. In short, what I am driving at is that cosmic omnipresence pervades the universe at three distinct levels. The first is the gross, where cosmic energy resides in atoms, which, as all of us know, are there everywhere in the universe. Next, cosmic energy operates in all living systems, as what Vedanta describes as prana, and what we would term the mysterious life force. Finally, at the highest and subtle level, cosmic energy exists as the energy of primary consciousness, probably as a field that is still beyond today's physics. It will remain so unless physics itself becomes enlarged to go beyond time and space that describe our particular universe. Once you grant that consciousness pervades the entire universe and is also the source of all feeling, as well as of all energy, as well as of our universe, as well as of all things inanimate and animate, we just cannot afford to ignore it. Rather, we had better be aware of it and tune our actions accordingly. That is what I mean by cultivating awareness. I hope you get the general idea. I might also add that once this awareness exists, then automatically our actions would be dharmic in all their aspects. In other words, it means we would conform to Mama Dharma, which is the pitch I am making in the companion series of lectures on the Gita. I must, before I leave this topic, make a reference to prejudice. Primitive people are supposed to be superstitious, biased and all that. But when scientists themselves indulge in speculation that far outweighs even science fiction, that is considered perfectly respectable. Take the following example. In quantum mechanics, there is a thing called duality of existence. Matter, as we know, is capable of exhibiting, especially at the level of atoms, a dual nature. It can appear to be made of particles or it can appear to be wave-like. This may sound absolutely crazy to ordinary people, but for nearly 80 years now, the world of physics has got used to this dual nature of matter. By the way, experiments confirm this dual nature of matter. Nevertheless, the question still remains, what precisely is the nature of matter? Is it wave-like or is it matter-like? Or is it sometimes wave-like and sometimes matter-like? And when is it what? And so on. Actually, this sort of question engaged the minds of most brilliant people in the early part of 20th century, including the founders of quantum mechanics. Niels Bohr, the man who laid the foundations for the philosophy underlying quantum mechanics, said that when it exists all by itself, matter is at once both wave-like and particle-like. But the moment an experiment is set up to observe it, that piece of matter presents itself in just one form. If the experiment is designed to detect a wave, matter would appear like a wave. If it is designed to detect a particle, matter would appear like a particle. Sounds very much like Yad Bhavam Tad Bhavati, does it not? Indeed, that precisely is what Niels Bohr, the high priest of quantum mechanics, declared. Naturally, there was a fierce debate, particularly between Bohr and Einstein. And Erwin Schrodinger, the founder of the wave aspect of quantum mechanics, designed a funny paradox called the cat paradox that was meant to actually pour ridicule on Bohr's hypothesis. But you know what? Today, the Bohr interpretation is not only widely accepted, but is the official dogma of quantum mechanics. The language one uses is, the wave function of matter is a superposition of both aspects of quantum reality. But when an actual observation is made, the wave function collapses on to one of the two possible states. Reflect on this for a moment. From the perspective of the man on the street, this is an absolutely bizarre statement. And yet, most eminent physicists accept it without batting an eyelid. In fact, you would be astounded by some of the hypotheses of modern physics, like the many-world interpretation of quantum mechanics, that would beat the craziest science fiction hollow. Yet, no one raises eyebrows or pours sarcasm. True, not all agree with all these interpretations, but even the dissenters simply say, it's a point of view, but our view is different. My argument is simply this. In the lowest version of quantum mechanics, which, by the way, we now teach to our BSc level students, the centerpiece is the wave function. Being a complex quantity, meaning it involves a complex number with an imaginary component, the wave function is not a physical observable. Yet there is not one physicist in the world who would say the wave function is pure fiction, bunk, nonsense and things like that. Nobody protests and says, how can a complex, unreal thing drive the real world? The fact is that 70 and odd years of rigorous investigations have shown that we simply cannot do without the wave function, but with it we can do wonders. Believe it or not, without the wave function, there would be no silicon technology, no microprocessor, no PC, no mobile phone, no digital camera, etc. Would you believe that? What I am driving at is that if we can allow the wave function to rule our lives, if the man in the street says, well, Schrodinger says the wave function exists even though I cannot see it and touch it, then why cannot the scientists also say Schrodinger ultimately accepted the highest teaching of Vedanta, namely Atman pervades everything? If the man in the street can say, well, there is after all a quantum aspect to nature as Max Planck discovered in 1900, then why cannot scientists who have named so many institutes and even one satellite of Planck also accept what Planck said, namely, from consciousness came material reality? By the way, I hope all that I have tried to say in this talk would help you to appreciate what exactly Swami means when he says, I am in you, above you, below you, around you, etc., etc. We all applaud loudly but seldom pay attention to how profound that statement is. If we realize that God resides in every living being, would we dare to hurt it or destroy it? If we realize that God is immanent in rocks as well as mountains, would we shamelessly quarry hills as we see happening all over Andhra Pradesh and Karnataka? If we realize that God not only gave us air to breathe, but is also hiding in air, would we pollute it so badly as we are doing these days? If we understand that God is in fact the energy of the atom, would we dare to harness that energy for making deadly bombs? So this business of building up and developing awareness is not a trivial issue, as many tend to think. I'm afraid I've said many complicated things, and so I think I'd better do some summing up. One, I started by saying that I'm trying to discuss the omnipresence of God. Two, this omnipresent God that I'm talking about is the abstract formless God. Three, in the manifested universe, God is present in three distinct aspects. Firstly, God is present as the power immanent in the atom. Since atoms are to be found everywhere in the universe, God too is immanent everywhere in the manifested universe. Five, scientists may be able to give a physical explanation for the presence of energy in the atom. But, according to me, the question remains, where did that energy originally come from? This is where Gandhi's observation about an indefinable, mysterious power pervading the universe becomes very pertinent. Six, the omnipresence that I just mentioned is common to inert as well as living beings. In living beings, God is present or immanent at a still higher level also, that of prana or life force. Seven, there is a still higher level, which is the level of pure consciousness. This is present in active form in humans. It is this that enables humans to see God, that is, if humans want, both within and without. Pure consciousness is supreme, which means it can exist all by itself. Stated differently, when the universe disappears, it dissolves into pure consciousness, as Krishna described. Nine, one should not imagine that when the universe is created, the primordial background of universal consciousness would disappear. No, the latter continues to exist, acting as a backdrop in the manifested universe. 10. I hold that this backdrop acts rather like a physical field, driving the evolution of living species in the direction where consciousness flowers fully, rather like a fruit bud growing and ripening later into a sweet fruit. 11. Where evolution of life is concerned, that fruit is the human being. Okay, suppose one grants all this, what's the bottom line? According to me, the bottom line is the following. Man must be aware that he is the spark of the divine. This divine is no ordinary thing. It is omnipresent in the physical universe in every piece of gross matter, is present as a life force in every living entity and is present as consciousness or self-awareness in all living entities. Particularly in humans, this consciousness can, if harnessed, enable humans to not only cognize the divinity latent within, but also enable man to recognize his cosmic nature and his cosmic connection with the entire cosmos. As such, man has the responsibility of ensuring that all his actions are in total harmony with the cosmos in all its aspects. I hope that's not a mouthful. Don't worry, I shall repeat this message many times in different ways later on, so that you get the important idea. Thank you for listening. Jai Sai Ram.
You have been listening to a talk by Professor G. Venkatraman in the series Musings from Prashantinilayam. This broadcast came to you from the studios of Radio Sai.
एकंकार सतनाम करता पूरक निरपार निर्वैर अकाल मूरत अजूनी सेवन गुरु प्रसाद जप आद सच जुगाद सच है भी सच नानक होसी भी सच
भगवंत Sahih Khuda.